The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and welcome to the Conscience of Psychiatry. I have a marvelous guest today. Before introducing him, this show is pre-recorded to be played on Monday at my usual 5 p.m. time, because on Monday I will be in Winnipeg, Canada. I'm going to be testifying in a trial, a criminal trial, in which a 17-year-old boy was given Prozac, got worse and more agitated, more upset, more sleepless, and unfortunately, the doctor raised his dose, and shortly after, it makes me stutter just thinking about it. Shortly after, this young man stabbed a friend to death with hardly any known provocation at all, and I'm going up to talk about the role of Prozac. Now, in Canada, there's a specific warning from the Canadian government, and it states that these drugs can cause harm to self and others. So it's the Canadian warning, very specific, harm to self and harm to others. And, of course, this youngster not only caused grievous harm to someone else, he's in jail. The amount of damage done by these psychiatric drugs is immeasurable. I really think that we have an epidemic of suicide, violence, and mania, loss of relationships, loss of jobs, loss of spirituality that is just huge on this massive number of psychiatric drugs we're giving out. And last week I focused on the military and giving these drugs to young people. The hazards are probably greater in children, youth, and young adults. And here we have a youngster ruining the lives of others and ruining his own life on Prozac. My guest today is Alberto Ferguson. You've heard him call in before for a long conversation. Alberto was a very much appreciated speaker at our conference this past April. And by the way, the conference is scheduled now again for April next year in Syracuse, April 13, 14, and 15. We're already getting sign-ups. The hotel's already getting inquiries. We're going to have a wonderful group of people coming again from around the world. And my video on empathic therapy, where I interview three different patients for an hour apiece, I give an introduction. We have comments from other therapists in the audience, and then comments at the end by other therapists. So there's a real interchange of viewpoints on how to be an empathic therapist. That is sold out. It's first printing, and we're doing another printing now. And the only place right now that you can sign up for that is on my website, bregin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com. Now, Alberto is a psychiatrist. And he's a psychiatrist who's really on the cutting edge in terms of what he is working on therapeutically. He's certainly more cutting edge than I am, because he's trying to to develop and is developing a form of therapy in which the therapist is no longer really in the role of therapist. The therapist becomes a kind of catalyst, and the patient studies and learns how to rehabilitate himself or herself. It's called self-rehabilitation, I think is the latest term that Alberto is using. Alberto consults in the United States, but his project and his home is in Colombia, South America, where he's speaking to us from Skype right now. My dear friend and wonderful innovator in psychiatry, and I'd call it, say, psychotherapy, but beyond psychotherapy. Hello, Alberto.
Hi, Dieter.
Alberto, we haven't really talked much about the conference. How'd you feel about the conference?
Oh, it was a great event. It was, in many respects, it was scientifically great. It was great to see old friends, to know new people. It was great, Dieter.
Yeah, we were very, very pleased with it, and people enjoyed your presentation very much. So, Alberto, a good enough starting point would be to explain to folks what it is that you are doing and trying to do.
Well, I prefer the last phrase. It's what I'm trying to do. That's more realistic in a way, I imagine. Well, we began to work actually in 1982, and we decided to work with so-called homeless and so-called mentally ill people, and mainly people diagnosed with schizophrenia. So that's how we began many years ago. And in the beginning, we basically we had a very simple hypothesis at the beginning. It was a kind of a truism in a way. We just thought that so-called people with schizophrenia have exactly the same needs as any human being, which, of course, is a truism. And so with that in mind, we began to realize and to see that although that was the case, people diagnosed with schizophrenia were not being able to receive and have anything, all the things that any human being has. So our very first emphasis was to build a program in which these people really got what any human being needs, and make sure that they wouldn't get what any human being does not need, which means some such simple things of respecting their basic human rights, as you know, and unfortunately, in many of treatments in psychiatry, some of the basic human rights are not respected. So that was kind of the beginning, Peter.
And in the beginning, you were taking a more basic therapeutic approach, I gather, and then you more and more began to work on educating the individual. And we're talking about really disturbed folks, not just people labeled schizophrenic, but people from the streets. How did you make contact with people from the streets, and how do you do that now? How do you get these folks into your program?
Well, that's a very important piece of the whole program, how to engage people. You know, that beginning makes a whole difference. So probably this happens nowadays, but you remember 1982, it was quite a new thing to really make it a voluntary thing, you know? So we really just kind of engaged the person on the street. We talked with them. We began to chat, and we had developed, a safe haven, or some people would like to call it a therapeutic community. I don't know. Anyway, it was a place where people could work and have relationship with others. And art and work were the two main tools of, let's call it, the rehabilitation process.
So you would invite these people to come into your program, And who paid for it? Was the state, Columbia, paying for it?
So that was tough, as you can imagine. Well, we had a very small help from the state, but basically we had some pro bono work, and many of my colleagues, meaning some psychiatrists, some psychologists, social workers, nurses, occupational therapists, who believed in this new approach and gave part of their time. And we got some private donations for this program. Not very big ones, but we were able to kind of move on.
Now, were you helping in the beginning two or three patients at a time, or an occasional person, or how was it working in the beginning? And
well, in the beginning, we very quickly grew to a number of, we got a place where 80 people lived together with lots of this professional that I mentioned to you. And gradually, our emphasis was, as you mentioned at the beginning, we changed from becoming the experts, and we decided that we had so many failures, so many difficulties, that the only thing that was reasonable to recognize is that we really ignored what really schizophrenia was, that we really ignored how the brain functions. And so, in a way, that was our turning point, when we kind of told all the folks in our program, look, we've tried many things, but we failed. So you really have to become the leaders of the process, and we're just going to accompany you. And that was the beginning of these two words of accompanied self-rehabilitation, which initially we called accompanied autoanalysis. But we prefer to call it accompanied self-rehabilitation, meaning that the leadership of the process is really taken by the person himself, and we so-called therapists, the most we can do is to just accompany the person in their process. And so we began to really become study what does accompany mean, and what are the best ways to really accompany a person without intruding too much and respecting that they are the leaders of their own process, and never forgetting, this is very important in our program, Peter, all that we and all that science ignores about how the brain works and what mental illness is, if it happens to be something.
And now you've gone from autoanalysis to autorehabilitation. I guess to get across the idea that this is really very broad, with a lot of different ways of people helping themselves?
Yes, yes, exactly. I would say that every person has to really find his own way. There's no way to really build kind of rigid protocols on what has to be done. Our biggest conviction and the data that we have until now really shows that the person becoming the leader seems to be the main factor. We did lots of research studying what we would call successful cases. And you know, one of the main thing in any successful case of rehabilitation with any disability it happens when a person really decides and is able to become the leader of his own process. And science, physicians, caregivers, psychiatrists, whatever, we all become people who support them in their process, which is theirs, and they have to be the leaders.
Now, how do you, at the present time, are people still live in your facility?
Well, no, there has been lots of changes throughout these years. As I mentioned, we began in 1982. About 10 years ago, beginning of about 2001, I think, we realized that we had been able to build a different institution, which was not an asylum-like institution, which was, of course, free, people could move, but nevertheless, it was an institution, Peter, and that's a problem. And then we realized that we had to get rid of the institution of such, because no matter how much you change an institution, it's still an institution with all the difficult things that happen in those places. meaning that there's something superficial, something, let's say, artificial, let's say, in the relationships, in the way of life. So unless people really decide to become the owners of their own life and be in charge and go out there to do whatever they can do, they will never really recover. The level of recovery in an institution, it's our belief nowadays, is limited by the institution itself, no matter what the structure of the institution is. So nowadays, we really, what we have, we prefer to call it, like, let's say, like a movement, like it's something that happens within the community, and people move around, and we accompany them in that process. They, at the most, they could say that they belong to, let's say, our program, let's say our philosophy, but they are definitely not in the, in an institution, but they are in the real life. And the, you see what we've done in all these years shows that people with schizophrenia and homeless people, which supposedly would be the people who would have more difficulty to recover, they can recover. And you know, there was lots of data out there many years ago, but I don't know why mental health professionals don't want to see those data. You just have to remember the great studies of Courtney Harding, let's say, and remember her famous paper on the seven myths about mental illness, her great Vermont study, where she showed very clearly that not thanks to psychiatry or to us, but in spite of us, more than half of the people, after many years, recovered, right? So, so there's lots of data to support.
So what, you reach out to people who are on the streets? Do you actually have people in your program that meet people on the streets and offer something to them or talk to them?
Oh yes. I mean, our main target, let's say, continues to be so-called homeless people diagnosed with schizophrenia. The difference is that now we are very well known in the, let's say, in the homeless community, and so they come to us, right?
And where do they come to? They just find you on the street, or do they come to a building?
Yes, we have several small buildings now where they can reach us. They know how to contact us, and they come to reach us, no?
Uh-huh.
And,
do you have any idea how many people are in the program? It must be hard to keep track. This is such a spontaneous thing.
Yeah, currently, well, of course, there are lots of different ways to belong to the program.
That's what I'm thinking, yes.
Yes, but many people, we don't see them for several months, and then they come back. But more or less, the amount of people we have in our program are currently around 300, probably. We have never wanted to have too many people. Our emphasis is not in obtaining big figures of people who we see. But what we want is basically to do things well done and to show and to uncover all the great myths about mental illness, mm-hmm. especially about schizophrenia.
How many professionals do you have involved for the 300?
The group of professionals is it's always varied between 30 and 40 people, meaning all the. But besides all the, let's say, typical mental health professionals, we also have all sorts of people involved in a part-time basis, because we have philosophers. We have to give you a broad idea of what we have. We have some architects, because you see, we think that being able to design a suitable way to live your everyday life is very important. So we found that architects, which was a surprise for us, are so important for mental health, you know, and they've been doing great work giving people information about the basics of how to live your everyday life in a house. They have lots of things to say. So we're really involved very different types of professionals in our program.
So let's say that you have Mr. Jones, and I guess it wouldn't be Mr. Jones in Columbia. And he, you know, he has come to the program or met somebody from the program and comes to visit you. Who's going to see him first?
All the team is completely horizontal. Anybody of the team is qualified to see the person for the same time, including some, let's say, recovered people, which are the best in doing the first engagement, no? So,
and what happens in that first engagement? I'm sure, I know we're talking about things that are very unstructured, spontaneous, oriented to the individual's wishes and needs. But could you give us an idea what it's like in that first session with perhaps you or someone you know?
Yes. Let's talk about the Mr. Jones you mentioned, which of course is not called like that here, right? But yes, when Mr. Jones comes, the important thing is that in that first engagement, that first, let's call it interview, which can happen on the streets, on a building, wherever, in a park, wherever it happens, anybody from our program has our basic philosophy. What do I mean by that? That the person really has in mind that he's going to be in front of a person who happens to be homeless or who happens to have a diagnosis of schizophrenia. But really, the people in our program know that they're in front of a human being and not of a pathology, you know? Which this might seem very obvious to some of our audience, but as you know, Peter, this is something that we have struggled for a long time, because one of the things that has happened, unfortunately, with psychiatry is that people sometimes tend to become a pathology, and we forget that they are also a person, or that they basically a person which happens to have a certain pathology. So that's a very important attitude, let's say, in the beginning. And then we acknowledge immediately that we don't have the answer for their problem at all, that we acknowledge all that we ignore, and we tell them a bit about that. We tell them about a little about all the different schools in psychology and psychiatry, all the things that science doesn't know. Although we show them some of the basic research that has been done, and so that to allow them to understand that we don't have the answer for their program, that the best we can do is to accompany them in becoming experts in themselves, experts in how they are, and to accompany them to try to build a lifestyle that suits them. No, you see, what we've seen through all these years is that most of the people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia, if they are able to discover a lifestyle that suits them, they can be free of the so-called illness. Maybe they will remain with certain peculiarities or whatever, but they will not be ill in the classical sense, meaning that they will be able to sleep, they will not hallucinate, they will not be delusional, they will not be suicidal. Although they can choose, let's say, strange ways of living, no? So in the whole of our program, we are very open and people to find open very special lifestyles that can suit them without, let's say, related there.
You're breaking up a little bit. I'm not sure what we can do about that since you're on Skype and coming a long way by satellites, I guess. But just to the audience again, okay. We're talking to my friend, psychiatrist Alberto Ferguson, about self-rehabilitation, where the individual is not looked upon as a patient, but as someone to be accompanied in finding a creative lifestyle for themselves that's meaningful to them. And that when that happens, the classical symptoms of psychosis recede or disappear. He is in Colombia, South America, Now, you're giving us some idea, Alberto, of what this conversation looks like. What might be some of the subjects that the person might bring up? You bring up the different schools and approaches. You bring up that you don't have the answers. I imagine you bring up that your goal is you want to accompany them to a better lifestyle for themselves. But might you say that to them?
Tell me, if I'm breaking too much, I can try a different system to call you back again immediately. Do you want...
Are you there? You're gone. Okay.
Do you hear me?
No, you broke up. Why don't you call back, and I'll talk for a few minutes while you call back, and we can take a break in about 5 minutes, and you can work it out further, all right?
Okay, I'll call back soon. Okay.
Okay. This is Peter Bregan, and I'm going to stay on this show with folks. One of the really interesting things about the treatment of people who are labeled schizophrenic is the huge diversity in what has been done to them and the real lack of diversity of what they've been encouraged to do for themselves. Throughout the centuries, going back 200 years and more, organized psychiatry has treated these folks like they have a brain tumor and you got to beat it out of them. You got to bleed it out or give them fevers or purge them or whip them or dunk them or frighten them. I mean, all these various things that have been done over the years in psychiatry have never treated the individual as a being, a person like you or me who needs, as Alberto said, the very basic things that you and I need, only maybe more so, maybe more love, maybe more patience, more consideration, more courtesy, more empathy, more security. These are fragile souls, from my viewpoint. They're often like broken poets. They hear things, they may see things, they imagine things, and it's often very stereotyped things because their spirit is yearning for meaning, and they're producing meanings, but they're broken or incoherent or difficult to relate to meanings. So on the other side, from my colleagues in psychiatry who have been brutalizing these folks and continue to brutalize them with electroshock and with lobotomizing drugs that in fact suppress the ability to find a lifestyle, suppress the ability to be a person, all the psychiatric drugs given to these patients with these descriptions of being schizophrenic, all the treatments are lobotomizing, subduing. They produce docility. You don't accompany the person, you dominate and control the person. The exact opposite of what Alberto Ferguson is talking about. And then on the other end, you've also had increasingly growing over the last 100 years and even 200 years, ideas about a more spiritual, caring, empathic approach to helping people. And that flourished for a time even in institutions that offered what was called at the time moral therapy, not moral psychiatry, but moral therapy, run in the 1700s and 1800s into a little bit into the 1900s, where psychiatrists played little or no role. Physicians were often not really involved, and these facilities were often run by Quakers or other religious denominations, and people were offered faith and hope and charity and caring. And the attendants were trained in being courteous and responsible and responsive to these individuals in ways that nowadays attendants in hospitals aren't trained. And that flourished, and it worked with all kinds of people. But then it runs smack dab into organized psychiatry. And everywhere these experiments have been conducted in the Western world, organized psychiatry has slammed the door shut on them. The academicians, the professors have slammed the door shut and hidden the effectiveness and often persecuted the people
who, I would say, in fact, inevitably and invariably persecuted the people who have promoted these caring approaches. Most recently, we had Soteria House in the United States, run by Lauren Mosher, who was very much persecuted for showing that people labeled schizophrenic could be helped in home-like caring centers that were really just houses with therapists who were empathic, caring human beings and not even professionals, with maybe one professional supervising. And that program, Soteria House, you can find it in my books. You can find it on the web. S-O-T-E-R-I-A was shut down, Soteria House. But we have now Alberto Ferguson taking this a step further, a giant step further, and organizing a program that it lacks a formal institution that relates to people on the streets of Colombia and that in South America, and that offers them, when they want it, when they come to them, guidance, a guided experience of building their own lives in a new and more creative way. And we're going to take a break now, and hopefully as we come back
I'm here again, Peter, so I'll be here on the break.
Yes. And when the break comes back, Alberto will be with us, and hopefully he'll be better connected when we come back. Could we have our break now?
Listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Did you miss your favorite show on Progressive Radio Network? Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com anytime, day or night, for all of our great shows. Don't be left out and miss important shows and information. Visit ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and be in the loop.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
All right, hello, this is Peter Bragan again. I'm recording, and I'm recording from home rather than from my usual little studio that I have worked out in my office. We may have some glitches on and off today, or maybe not, depending on the editing. But we're having an interesting show, and we're talking about interesting matter, which is how to help people who have become so ineffective in their lives and lost control, in my view, over their mental processes and their self-determination, that they get labeled schizophrenic, that they may end up on the streets. And how do we help these folks? And the emphasis over the centuries has been basically to beat them up one way or another, shock them, drug them, lock them away, humiliate them. And of course, this is even worse for folks who are that sensitive and that injured than it would be if you put a, you know, a fully trained SEAL into that kind of situation. But no human being can handle the kind of, quote, treatment, really abuse, that's been generally heaped upon the folks that get that diagnosis or who act crazy and act profoundly disturbed. And yet we know more and more that what is really needed is the same thing that every other human being needs, and even more so because they need to be welcomed back into humanity. To me, psychosis is simply a complete loss of trust and connectivity to other human beings. We talk about a break with reality. What reality do we mean? We don't mean that the person is broken with reality so they can't drive a car or operate a television or even get online. We mean they're broken with the reality of human relationship. They have bizarre ideas about human relationship or frightening and terrifying ideas. They're always scared. They always feel humiliated. They simply do not feel able to participate in society or even into simple one-to-one relationships. And what we're describing or hearing described today by Alberto Ferguson is really on the frontier of reaching out and offering whatever support these folks are able to determine for themselves that they need. And what a careful dance this must be between the person called the therapist, if I'm not even sure Alberto Ferguson's group in Columbia, South America is still using that term. But what an interesting relationship it must be. And I'm hoping Alberto will now give us even some more insight into the kinds of exchanges and conversation that might take place in this guided self-rehabilitation. Alberto?
Yes, here I am, Peter. Are you hearing me a bit better now?
Yes, you're fine.
Okay, good.
Tell, give us a flavor some more of what goes on in a session. Does it last an hour? Is it open-ended? Does it vary? What sorts of subjects? What might the person do after a session? Give us a flavor of what these encounters are like.
Yes, Peter. Everything did have a big change since we moved, let's say, from this a bit of old-style, we could say nowadays, therapeutic community we had, which was good. It was good. It was an advance compared to the old asylum, let's say, but it was not enough. But when we moved from this still institution in a therapeutic community to the community, many of the things began to happen, including what you're asking. But let me tell you one thing before. For example, one of the biggest things was that all the activities that were done before within the therapeutic community are now done in the small town, which is a small town north of Bogota, where our program works, no? All throughout the town. It's a small town. And the interesting thing is that in all the activities, there's a lot of mixture of people, no? And people who certainly have no diagnosis of mental illness are very active in all our meetings. Things have begun to change in the town a lot. I mean, people think, and the mayor of the city thinks, that the coming of all the so-called mentally ill people has been a blessing, which, as you know, this is extraordinarily different from what has happened throughout history with mentally ill people, were discriminated against. So they're valued a lot. One of the strategies we began, which was so useful, and I really something I would like to recommend to people, is that we worked a lot with the schools, the nurseries in the schools, to have in the curriculums of the schools invite people to change the image that small children have about what a mentally ill person is. No, this is something we're going to do kind of 15 or 20 years ago, and it had begun to make a difference. I mean, to work with the small children, talking to them about what mental illness is and what it's not, and trying to destroy the myths of that. And that has been very helpful. So, because we now have, a generation of people that are growing with a different image of what mental illness is, you know? Again, if it happens to be something, no? So that has made a lot of a difference, and that's something I would really recommend. Coming to your question, it's
very
open.
By the way, I'm really glad to hear that, because I didn't know much about this part of your work, and clearly some of the most successful programs in our field have involved communities, and the whole concept of community mental health, which you are so far beyond, I won't paint you with that phrase, but working with the whole community to help all of its citizens, including those that are struggling. And it sounds like people come from outside the town to be in your program?
Yes, they do. Oh, yes. Yes, they come from throughout the country in a way. Oh, yes, they do. The interesting thing is that not only people who have been diagnosed with any sort of mental illness, but it's just people who are beginning to understand that if they interact with a person diagnosed with a mental illness, they grow a lot, you know? And there's a lot of interesting things, and that people who have gone through the process of being diagnosed as a mentally ill person, especially those who are, in my opinion, rightly called survivors, in a way, who have been able to survive through the process, there are lots of things they can teach to others, to any human beings, about what being human kind of really means, sort of, no? So yes, it's become a kind of a big movement, in a way. That's why one of the things we like about our current state of things is that it's definitely not an institution. It's more a social movement. If we had to choose a name, I would say that what's happening is a social movement in which has not only changed the what mental illness means, but it has also begun to change lots of the things that what being human means. Because you see, when someone who has never been diagnosed with a mental illness listens to a person telling them how important it is to really develop your own genuine personal lifestyle, how important it is to be in charge of your life, how important it is to become the owner of your own life, then this is good for everybody, for any human being, no? So it's been a very interesting school that we don't know where we're going to get, you know? I don't know where this is going to get us, but it's moving in very surprising and very new directions.
It's all very, very exciting. Do you have a website in English?
We're building it, Peter. We're building it. Yes, we do have. I'm going to give the name. It's www.selfrehabilitation.org. Right now, it's you're going to see very simple things, but we're going to change it very soon, and you'll hear about this, and you can read about this in detail. At the present time, you'll just see a couple of quick things, but I hope that very soon we'll have a much better website. In English.
Wonderful. www.selfrehabilitation.org?
Yeah.
www.selfrehabilitation.org. Now, help me understand what you might do when you meet someone, since you're the...
Oh, yes, yes.
What goes on in there? Give us a flavor.
Yes. The typical thing would be, of course, that's something that's we all agree on, is to listen, of course, to listen to the person, to really listen, which is such a difficult art to really do, no? But that's the basic thing, to really listen, to be genuinely interested in their lives. Not like if we were doing a clinical report of something, but as a human thing, as a biography, no? We really are interested in listening and hearing what the stories are. As you can imagine, people who come to us come with such incredible stories about what they've been doing on the streets throughout the country. Let me tell you something about that. It's wrong to talk about homeless people. I'm sure that when people talk about homeless, they don't mean homeless. Probably they could mean houseless, but not homeless, right? I mean, home is a different concept from house, you know? So, we play with these words because it's important, though. Many people on the streets, they do have a home, although they don't have a house. They have a home, in meaning that they do have loving relationships with other people on the streets, and so they have a home. And on the other hand, as you know, Peter, many people who have a house, they don't have a home, right? So we really play with those words with them a lot, because it's important what we learn about that, because many of them, it's also a choice for some people. Some people choose in a way to do the life they want, so and they become let's say houseless. I prefer to use that word. There's a group of people in our program who defend that they should remain houseless in a way. So, and we respect that. And the only thing they themselves try to do is to be able to be houseless in a better way, with having access to health and to basic needs and basic things. But that's something, not even that, we're not going to force someone to change his condition and his lifestyle if he wants to keep it, or keep it for a while or whatever. But again, coming up to your question, so the sense of the typical thing that would happen, that we try to build in the first interview, in the first engagement, is to really create an atmosphere where we're going to work together to accompany them to find their way, and that we're going to do together, we're going to do a lot of research on themselves, and that we're just going to accompany them. And we try to...
Alberto, you're gone. I've lost Alberto Ferguson again. This is such an interesting conversation. The idea of somebody being schizophrenic, as in Thomas Zass's words, was a sacred symbol of psychiatry, that there were these individuals who had a specific disease that was supposed to be a brain disease. Or nowadays we say that they claim the biologically based brain disorder. And when you hear Alberto talking, and when you hear all the good folks in this field who are really helping other people, they're not addressing anything they think is an illness. There's no evidence that people who have so-called schizophrenia have a biochemical disorder. There's no evidence that they have a genetic disorder, believe it or not. I mean, there just isn't. No one is going to write an article proving it from all the studies we have, because the studies just don't make it. In fact, all the illnesses that these people have, physical illnesses, are caused by the drugs. We now have studies showing, I reviewed studies years ago in my books showing this, but now we have fresh studies showing that these drugs shrink the brain, the drugs used to treat these people, like Seroquel and Novane, the older drugs, Haldol, Stelazine, Thorazine, the older drugs, and Abilify, and Zyprexa, and Risperdal, they damage the brain horribly. They're toxic to all the cells in the brain. They're toxic to all the organs in the body. They cause, the new ones cause, life-threatening diabetes, obesity, elevated cholesterol. They cause tardive dyskinesia, that horrible movement disorder that disfigures the person and can totally disable a person and rack an individual with pain. They cause life-threatening neuroleptic malignant disease, which is a disorder which is like very much like a viral encephalitis. So we're not just talking here about helping the people who get these labels. We're talking also about setting them free, giving them alternatives that won't horribly damage their brains, their bodies,
and also shorten their lives. We know that these drugs long-term catastrophically shorten lives. Now, I don't know if Alberto in Colombia is still cut off. The satellites aren't working well today. Alberto, can you hear
me? I'm back, Peter, and I have to apologize for all the difficulties we've been having in the communication. I'm sorry about that.
Well, it's fine. It gives me a chance to talk a little. I'm getting feedback from folks that they want me to talk a little more on the shows, and I tend to listen on the shows. So it's working out fine, Alberto. Let's come back again to what it may be like to be in your program for someone. If you can talk about that.
Yes, I was kind of I was about to give you an example of the things that have changed. Remember, let's say old style clinical meetings where you or me as a psychiatrist would be in the head of a table, of a round table, and would be and everybody would be kind of in a way waiting to see what we say, and we would organize the meeting. So what we do nowadays is that there are some sort of clinical meetings, but they are headed by the so-called patient himself. No, so the patient is in charge of the meeting. The client, whatever you want to call it, whatever name you want to give it, and the client will be the leader of the meeting, and a psychiatrist, a nurse, a social worker, an occupational therapist would be around. And he, the person with a so-called mental illness, would be organizing the meeting, and he will ask everybody, okay, what do you think about my situation? What can you offer to me? I've been thinking in this. But even in that simple example, we emphasize and we try to push a bit the person to become the leader and understand that nobody has the answer. He doesn't have it. We're just there to give him or her some information so that that person decides what to do with his or her life.
So you might actually, I mean, a lot of these folks are just going to be totally unprepared to behave in that way. So a lot of your therapy, it sounds like, your accompaniment is going to be encouraging them to think for themselves, to ask you questions, to come up with ideas of their own?
Yes. And, you know, we've realized that the way that this can be done is that if our group, the people in our team, let's say, are really convinced of what I said initially today, of all that we ignore and all that science ignores. So it's a genuine thing. It's not a fake, right? It's not that we are being like a false modesty, sort of.
Yeah, you're not
it's
patronizing
real.
The patient.
I'm sorry?
You're not patronizing the patient.
Exactly.
And I one of the things that's remarkable about how you discuss these things is how much emphasis you put on philosophy as the whole starting point. And I know that a dear friend of mine who's gone now, Kevin McCready, who ran one of the few clinics in the country that was drug-free. It was a day clinic with a lot of different services and opportunities. He always wanted to talk more of the philosophy and feels like you. It's just so important to give this new philosophy that is so oriented around the client. It's just a huge further step in client direction. Now, do you make things available to the clients? Do you tell them there are libraries here, or here's a shelf of books, or on drugs? Let's say the patient's on psychiatric drugs. Would you say, well, you might want to read these books that will show you the pros and cons?
Yes, we do. We show them all the, let's say, all the big resources of the small town where our program works. And as far as medication is concerned, yes, we have, without your permission, we have translated a piece of your works, And so they, we offer them pieces of your books, of your writings, which are very important for them, no? And of course, they can access any other writing also, and they can get their own conclusions and arrive to their own conclusions. And they usually, if they, when they, after studying, after understanding really what science knows, what science doesn't know, after reading the details of all what's been said by science on medication and studying it carefully, most of them really decide that they have to try to see other alternatives to recover and to go about their lives instead of medication.
I imagine that many of them have been on medication for many, many years, so they'll need some guidance coming off, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And so most of them have used medications in their past, as you can imagine. And certainly they receive all the information on how to get out of them, yeah.
So it sounds like everyone who might meet with these people is going to be coming from this common philosophy of empowering the individual to rehabilitate themselves, to choose a better lifestyle for themselves. And so the conversations, it sounds like, are hard to describe because they're just going to vary so much depending on what the person brings into the session, who is the client, and what the other person is going to bring in.
Yes, what? They really vary enormously, Peter. That's right. That's right.
Now, do you have names for the roles? Is it therapist and client? I don't think it can be therapist because it's broader than that. What kind of terms do you use?
Well, the official name we use is the accompanied and accompanying person, let's say, right? Somebody is accompanying another person. That's the word we prefer, but any word, other words are not forbidden, let's say. Many people still use the word therapist. Okay, that's that if they want to use it, they can use it, but the word we encourage is accompanied and accompanying person.
How do you say that in Spanish?
Persona acompañada y el acompañante.
That sounds better in Spanish.
Yes, it's complicated. It's a bit complicated in English. You know, one other very important thing, Peter, I don't want to lose this opportunity to mention it. Another thing we've been doing is that we've been inviting, you know, residents of psychiatry, of psychology, students of psychiatry, for whatever school they belong, to be part of the program. And this has been important because they've been able to see the change. We are okay talking, let's say, to official psychiatry. We've done great debates within the town on people who defend medication, and we invite them to talk, and they can tell the patients their views. They can do that, and they do that, and they hear all the different views, and that's been fascinating. That's fascinating because I'm beginning to see that the new generation of psychiatrists are a bit fed up with the excessive, let's say, excessive biological orientation of psychiatry. And, you know, there are movements worldwide of patients who are asking their psychiatrist, please listen to me at least before giving a medication.
Yeah, I'm picking up changes myself when I give talks now to professional groups, not usually psychiatrists, more often psychologists, social workers, counselors, and school personnel, that there's just a lot more openness and a lot more desire for new approaches. Has anyone done a video film of your movement, your program?
Yes, we've had two of them. One a very old one, which I think you saw sometime when we did in the early 90s, Peter.
Oh, yes, a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. We've been friends for a long time now, I realize. And yes, in the beginning of the 90s, that's an old one. And we're doing a new one, which we already have pieces of that, but I'll certainly send it to you, and we'll certainly have it in our new web page when it's ready.
And please have English subtitles.
Yes, we'll do that, sure. Yeah, sure, that's going to be very important, yes.
Well,
we need English subtitles, And we need your writings, Peter, to be translated into Spanish also.
Well, gosh, if you can give us a lead for that. You know, we've had a lot of trouble getting translated because organized psychiatry hears about it and intervenes in whatever country it is.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one country who was just about to go in the translation, and the psychiatrist told the publisher it would ruin psychiatry in the country if my book came out. A lot of power there that I could ruin psychiatry in a country, but it's been a real difficulty getting my books in translation. You'd think they'd be in many, many languages, but they're not. So anything you can do or anyone you can put us in touch with, this program could, if it inspired that, would be a miraculous improvement.
Right. Yeah, I understand what you mean, and I know how it is. But I'm slightly optimistic, Peter. I think that things are beginning to change even within official psychiatry a bit.
I think that's happening a little bit, yes. But the philosophy, the basic philosophy that you and I espouse, which is so close, although I practice in a, interestingly enough, you make me feel traditional. I am. I do more traditional therapy. By the way, do you work with families? Because I think families are so critical.
Yes. And, you know, that's important because today in the morning, one of the patients was saying in the meeting we have on Saturday morning, that it was today, we're recording this on Saturday. I know it's going to be airing on Monday. He said, okay, families are the best or the worst thing that happens to a human being. I know what he meant by that, no? So, because, yes, it's so powerful, no? Families are so powerful. So, in what we call the redesigning of a lifestyle, everybody really has to take into account what is he going to do about his family, whatever that means for him, no?
And I imagine that some folks decide it's time to let them go, and some try to reconcile.
Yes, and that can change through time also, and those are the type of process that we certainly respect, and everybody has to be. That's an example of how, in what sense, every human being has to be the leader of his own process, and when to leave his family, when to come back, how to do it, when to do it, because it's a matter of psychological survival. Many times it's a matter of life or psychological life or psychological death, you know, in a way.
Gentlemen, we got to wrap it up. We got a live show to go to. I'm sorry.
This is Dr. Peter Breggin thanking very, very much my friend, Dr. Alberto Ferguson, psychiatrist in Colombia, South America. You're listening today to The Cutting Edge, the most imaginative and creative new approach that's out there in terms of helping individuals who have been rendered houseless, in his words, and who have been labeled with diagnoses like schizophrenia. Thank you very much, Alberto Ferguson. Good night, all.
Thank you, Peter.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.